John Dressel is well known to many of you as a writer and as the proprietor of our neighbor down the street, Dressel's, another really special gathering place in St. Louis. I remember John from close to 20 years ago sharing a little office in the basement of a building at Washington University where we were both teaching assistants, and spending hours talking to him and trying to have him explicate this map of Wales which was stuck on the wall, and which he was dreaming of transforming into his physical environment, which he schemed and dreamed and managed to succeed in doing. Not only that, but his poetry was selected to win the Bardic Crown, an incredible, probably unprecedented feat for a non-Welsh native in Wales, the Eisteddfod Award. His most recent book are poems that grow out of his experience in Wales, called Out of Wales. He'll be reading from that and from some more recent material. Please welcome to his permanent home, John Dressel.
Thank you very much, Michael. I remember those days very well when we shared that office out in the basement of Dunker Hall, because I'm 9 years older than Michael. And he would always say to me about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, come on over to Dunker, to the Holmes Lounge, and we're all drinking coffee and talking about literature and poetry. And I say, you know, I've got a wife and two kids at home, and I've got to read all afternoon because I've been leading this life as I had been for 9 years of a businessman because of the family business in St. Louis, and I've got to go home and have a couple of martinis and put the kids to bed and tell them stories and see Barbara, you know. And Michael said, well, you know, you can do that later. You know, we're going to stay up all night. I said, well, that was the difference. We had a good time in those late 60s days at Washington, you know. Last week, as I understand it anyway, Camelot was playing in St. Louis, right?
Yeah.
And I thought I might, back in 1956, when Adlai Stevenson was a Democratic president, candidate for president, and later when John Kennedy ran against Nixon, the Republicans used to send around a truth squad afterwards to, Adlai would come and give a speech, or Kennedy and the senator, I don't know, the equivalent of Senator Laxalt or somebody would show up and give the truth. Well, whether we think they were telling the truth or not doesn't matter, but there was a truth squad that kind of came around to try to clean up the misimpressions that were given by the political candidates. And the first poem I'd like to read is an attempt to do a kind of a truth squad number on the vision and the version of King Arthur that the Camelot production gives. Because the legends we get through Lerner and Lowe finally, but through Tennyson and Mallory and so forth, they're transmogrified by continental romantic traditions, and these stories are originally Welsh. Arthur was probably, insofar as we can historically determine, a 6th century Romano-Briton, which means he was a Welshman who'd been living under the Roman occupation, and he'd learned something of military tactics, and particularly cavalry tactics, from them. And when the Romans had to leave to go home, you know, to defend the empire in 410, why, the Celtic peoples kind of took over for a while in the island of Britain until the Angles and Saxons became too numerous. But Arthur learned that stuff from his father, and he was probably the leader of a cavalry troop, because the the annals that we have available to us tell us that he ranged from southern Scotland. He fought the Picts down to southwestern England, where he defeated the Saxons at what they called Montus Badonicus in those days, because they wrote things in Latin. And in Welsh, probably that was Bathon, because it's probably near the city of Bath, which is probably not named because of the springs there, but because it relates to the Welsh pronunciation of the double D. And anyway, Arthur got around a lot, and he was a cavalry leader. And so I've often thought about, well, here's all this stuff. You know, we've got Leonard Bernstein has done Camelot, and we've got Mallory and Tennyson, we've got all this other stuff. And Arthur was a simple Romano-Briton who would learn some military tactics and led a cavalry troop, was a damn good soldier. What would he think about this? About Merlin, his sidekick. I'll talk about him later, who kind of becomes a Wizard of Oz. But this poem is called Note from a Soldier. Arthur was a soldier, not a king. The word for king in Welsh is Brenin. Arthur was Pendragon, which means head warrior. And so Arthur's kind of in this poem an American GI who's reflecting back upon all of the hoopla and the stuff that's happened to him. And you know, saying it's quite marvelous, really. But so it's called Note from a Soldier. It's big time, no doubt, and who wouldn't be flattered by such cosmic hoopla? All those bards and minstrels, frogs and wops and krauts, even the limeys getting in on the whoopee, as the English did by making him King of England, giving me a posthumous Victoria Cross, Hollywood, Broadway, cereals on the goggle box, cult loads of college kids mad for the paper box, the sidekick from Oz with a show of his own. Hell yes, pizzazz. I can take it like the next man. We need it. It helps us to understand Freud. Still, it's my life that they're mucking about with. And I often think back on it, given a mind, how I got start with horses and tactics from the Romans, raised my troop, traveled light and covered ground, gave them hell for leather on the Brython frontier, pulverized the Picts in what they now call Scotland, slammed the Saxons silly on the hill at Badon, they were bloody barbarians, VC or no, and put the West off limits for nearly 50 years. Yes, we were Welshmen, we knew how to fight, and we took on the bastards who were other than us, time after time, whenever they looked to be hot for our turf. We were good, I won't deny it. But it was no big deal. I mean, there wasn't all that razzmatazz with Magic Man and Super Sword, hordes of pretenders hobbling off to the Hernie Award, Lady Scuba Duba bobbling up from the lake, Neuter Goody Two Shoes panting after mystic goblets, half sister and punk nephew on Vendetta, the boat for Apple Island pushing off from Armageddon, the bug-eyed cock and bull shebang. We rode and fought and drank better than most. We made it with the local farm girls as we could. And in our turns, we bled and died. Madison Avenue took it from there. They hyped it till it came. It slew them in Peoria. Sometimes I damn near believe it myself. To read this other poem, I've really got to tell you kind of a long story, because out of the Mabinogion, which I'm sure some of the people here know very well. In the last branch of the Mabinogion, there's this story of the woman Bladarwith. Bladarwith means flower face, which when you learn in the end that she's changed into an owl makes sense, because if you think about the face of an owl, it's, you know, you got this little pupil in the middle and these feather patterns feathering out, and it does look like a flower. And these are very old Welsh tales, and they were written down. The manuscripts we have come from the 12th century, but they were written down, I mean, they were told orally for 1,000 years before that, 1,500 years before that. And so they got bastardized and, you know, transmuted in the process. And this particular story is about a wizard who creates a wife for his nephew from three flowers of the field, the broom and the oak and the meadowsweet. And Freudian interpreters of this tale tend to think that, well, she was cold-natured because she came from vegetable existence into human existence, and that's why all this stuff came about. My contention is that the man for whom she was created couldn't handle that. That she was perfectly, flowers are very sexual things, you know, and that she was created perfectly, you know, with a sexual capability, and that he couldn't handle that, and he was impotent, and all of this flows from that. That's the crux on which the story turns here as I tell it. But what happened was that she was created, and Uncle Gwydion kind of went off to do whatever else wizards do, and she stayed home with her husband, and he went off, and this hunting party came along. This nobleman named Grano came along with his hunting party, and she was there in the castle, and as the custom of the day would have required, she invited him to stay. So Grano stayed, and they fell in love, and she invited him to stay 3 nights, and they made love. And Grano says, you know, what can I do to get rid of your husband? Because we've really had a good time, and I'd like to, you know, to stay with you. And she says, well, he's got kind of an Achilles heel thing upon him because of Uncle Gwydion. And he can only be killed in a certain way, and I'm not sure what that is. And Grano says, well, then you find out. So she says to her husband, you know, darling, I really love you, and I'd like you to tell me how difficult it is to kill you so that I would rest easier. And so the sap that he is, you know, he does that, which involves building a spear which is only built on Sunday mornings while Mass is going on, which is a Christian interpolation on these old Celtic tales. But, okay, so he does that, and after that he's done that, he's got the spear, and she then says, well, now, what, you know, show me what else has to be done, because I'm really worried. I would hate to think that somebody could kill you. So he says, all right, I've got to go down to the bank of the river and stand on the back of this goat. Another fist's got to be in a bathtub, and this guy has to come out and throw this spear at me. So all this takes place, you see. But he's not killed. He's changed into an eagle. But it's a very unhealthy eagle. It's rotting. And old Uncle Gwydion the wizard comes along and says, you know, Bladaiwith and Grana go off to live supposedly happy ever after, but Uncle Gwydion comes along and says, hey, what happened to my nephew? And he finds this rotting eagle in the top of a tree, and he chants him down by using magic stanzas. The word for stanza in Welsh is englyn. And an englynwr is a person who makes stanzas, which is a word that occurs in the poem. So he gets him down, and right, he revives him, and they say, well, we got to revenge all this business. And they go and do such. And Bladaiwa's penalty is that she becomes an owl, which is a bird that only can fly by night and is shunned by other birds and so forth. And Grano, of course, is going to get killed, and Flau is going to throw the spear through him, and they go off by the bank of the river, and he says, can I have a boon, sir? And Flau says, of course. He says, well, the boon is I'd like to stand behind this boulder. Flau says, no problem. So he does, but he throws the spear, and it goes through the boulder. And then to this day, there are legends in Wales that persist that there are boulders along banks of rivers in Wales that have a hole through them. But anyway, he dies, but it's really a feminist poem, I think, because the point is that Bladaiwith gets the better of it, because I think the owl is a better metaphoric representation of the human condition than the eagle, which is it has to fly by night and do what it does and has to spit up the little fur balls at the end of things. So that's... I've taken a lot more time to explain this poem than it's going to take to read it. I'm sorry about that, but it's... But it's a very Welsh, very embedded in Welsh mythology. It's called, I call the poem Two Hoots for a Huntress, because she becomes a huntress when she becomes the owl, of course. It was flesh from flower, as the story goes, but to assert cold nature in the flesh seems wrong does not do justice to the pistol in spring sun. It was simply flesh without a carnal story, come of age from elsewhere for what that might be worth. Still, it knew a stud man when it saw one. I say it was Slough who had the cold within, who thought then felt a difference, who went limp from contemplation of her origins in bloom. So on came Grano, hot from his kill and ignorant as blood. He must have been good, she kept him extra nights, and if he found her less than lusty, nothing in the record shows it. What they did next is not to be admired, yet human enough, considering the context. The truth confessed to Slough, and Uncle Gwydion might have zapped her, might have run her back through flour all the way to mud. So she chose to try divorce, Brythonic style, and Slough could hardly wait to lace his impotence with sappiness, to spill his fatal beans, to almost earn his spear, posturing like some schoolboy on his guardian taboos. Even so, it wasn't murder. It was only eaglification.